verses 1 through 35. Jesus left the temple and was going away when his disciples came to point out to him the buildings of the temple. But he answered them, "You see all these, do you not? Truly, I say to you, there will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down." As he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, "Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" And Jesus answered them, "See that no one leads you astray, for many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and they will lead many astray. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not alarmed, for this must take place, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these are but the beginning of the birth pains. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and put you to death, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will fall away and betray one another and hate one another. And many false prophets will arise and lead many astray. And because lawlessness will be increased, the love of many will grow cold. But the one who endures to the end will be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. So when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let the one who is on the housetop not go down to take what is in his house, and let the one who is in the field not turn back to take his cloak. And alas for women who are pregnant and for those who are nursing infants in those days, pray that your flight may not be in winter or on a Sabbath. For then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been from the beginning of the world until now, no, and will never be. And if those days had not been cut short, no human being would be saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. Then, if anyone says to you, 'Look, here is the Christ,' or 'There he is,' do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and perform great signs and wonders, so as to lead astray, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you beforehand. So if they say to you, 'Look, he is in the wilderness,' do not go out. If they say, 'Look, he is in the inner rooms,' do not believe it. For as the lightning comes from the east and shines as far as the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send out his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. From the fig tree learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts out its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also, when you see all these things, you know that he is near, at the very gates. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away."
Well, whether you're a Christian or not, I bet you find the end of the world to be an interesting concept. Do we have any 21 Pilots fans here? Yeah. In their wildly popular Blurry Face album, there's a line that says, "I think about the end just way too much." It's fun to fantasize. And whether you're a Christian or not, I bet your imagination is quickly captured by this topic of the end of the world. In fact, this week I started reflecting on my own about how often this theme of the end of the world shows up in popular music. I don't mean in Christian hymns, I mean in popular music. And so often in American popular songs that talk about the end of the world, there's not only a description of what is coming with the end of the world, but an implication of how we should live now in light of it. It raises an important question. If the end of the world is coming, what do we do now? Listen to how some American artists answer that question. For example, Ariana Grande says, if the sun refused to shine, if the moon went dark tonight, and if it all ended tomorrow, would I be the one on your mind? And if it all ended tomorrow, would you be the one on mine? My summary of what Ariana Grande is saying is, if the end is coming, make sure you're with someone you love. Or maybe we could go back a little further than Ariana Grande to those great artists, R.E.M. That's great. It starts with an earthquake, birds and snakes and aeroplanes. Someone wants to get up and start singing, right? This means no fear, cavalier, renegade and steering clear, a tournament of lies. Offer me solutions, offer me alternatives, and I decline. And I feel fine. You know you want to sing. Here's my summary of what REM wants to say about the end of the world with earthquakes and aeroplanes and all of that. If the end is coming, make sure you feel fine. Then there's still a deeper answer embedded in American culture. I was dreaming when I wrote this, forgive me if it goes astray, but when I woke up this morning, could have sworn it was Judgment Day, because they say 2000, party over, oops, out of time. So tonight, I'm going to party like it's... According to the artist, who at that point was still known as Prince, if the end is coming, make sure you party like it's 1999. Well, considering some of these American answers to the question, if the end is coming, what should we do with our lives now? It raises an important question. What does Jesus have to say about the end? And what does Jesus think we should do with our lives now in light of that? If the end is coming, what does Jesus say about how we should live? Actually, for the next month, we're going to stay in Matthew chapter 24 and then Matthew chapter 25. And we're going to consider this question together about Jesus' view of the end. Today we pick up with what is probably the most complex part of Jesus' teaching on these topics. In fact, D.A. Carson, who has written gobs of books about the New Testament, says that this is one of the hardest passages in the Gospels to understand. And so I want to say up front, I'm going to do my best to try to lead us through this, but there are some parts of this passage that we're looking at today that I might not be right about. I'm not as certain about my understanding of some of these things as I am certain about other things about my understanding of other things I read in Scripture. But nonetheless, even in this passage, and certainly in the next few weeks to come, as we listen to what Jesus has to say about the end of the world and how we should live in light of it, we need to realize that this is not just like listening to REM's version of the end of the world as we know it. This is listening
to the teaching of our Lord Jesus Christ, who says, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. And he's got something he wants to say about the end. And he's got something he wants to say about how we should live now in light of it. And we would be wise to listen. To listen to his answers to these fascinating questions. I'll put my explanation of things under three headings today, and I'll tell you those three headings up front so you have some sense of where we're going. Part one, we'll think a little bit about the do not in Jesus' teaching. And part two, we'll think about the details in Jesus' teaching. And part three, we'll think about the discipleship in Jesus' teaching. Isn't that cute that they all start with D? Thank you. We'll begin with the do not in Jesus' teaching. But even as we start with the do not in Jesus' teaching, we kind of need to set the scene and understand where Jesus was when Jesus was having this conversation. According to Matthew chapter 24, Jesus was walking out of the temple, that is to say the second temple, not the temple that Solomon had built, and not a structure that exists today in the city of Jerusalem, but what we would call the second temple. And he's walking out of that temple, having said in Matthew chapter 23 some scathingly critical things of the leaders of the temple in his day, including some shocking words that seemed to speak against the revered temple itself. And as Jesus leaves this temple and leaves the city walls of Jerusalem and walks down into a valley and onto a Mount of Olives, or a mount called Olivet on the other side of the valley there, as he walks away, his disciples came, and you can almost envision them walking down into the valley and walking back up the hill and seeing the temple in all its glory. One of the most glorious buildings in the ancient world, by all accounts. And they look back with maybe this nostalgic wonder at the beauty of that building there in the city of Jerusalem. And the disciples come and they say, look at how beautiful it is. They point it out to him. And in verse 2, Jesus says something a little bit shocking. He says, you see all of those beautiful stones that construct that beautiful temple? Truly, I say to you, verse 2, there will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down. And he sits down on the Mount of Olives and begins what we call the Olivet Discourse in theological jargon. Basically, if someone says, what do you think about the Olivet Discourse? Usually that means they want to start an argument with you. Just a warning in the future. But I want to suggest that this teaching is here not to teach us to be argumentative, but to teach us to be disciples. He sits down on the Mount of Olives, and they come and they say, but wait, tell us. Notice their questions. When will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming at the end of the age? Two questions. When? And what's the sign? You see, in the minds of the disciples, when Jesus talks about the temple in Jerusalem being torn down so that not one stone of this beautiful building lays on top of the other, they assume that must be the end of the world. So they say, when's it going to happen? And what's the sign of the end? And Jesus begins answering these questions for them as they look at that beautiful temple building. Jesus begins his answer to them with these two questions. When is it going to happen? And what's going to be the sign of the end of the age? He begins answering their question not by directly answering them. Okay, I'll tell you when. Okay, I'll tell you what the sign is. He begins with answering their question with a negative answer. What isn't a sign of the end of the age? What should you not believe is a sign of the end of the age? What should you not be duped by? This is what I phrase as the do not in Jesus' teaching. Look with me, if you would, at verse 4. And Jesus answered their questions. Here's his first answer. See that no one leads you astray. This is an answer. Okay, I'll tell you the year. Okay, I'll give you the sign right away. He answers by saying, be careful not to be led astray. Or as another translation puts it kind of vividly, watch out for doomsday deceivers. Which is to say, what is the do not in Jesus' teaching? Essentially, Jesus is saying, do not be alarmed by doomsday prophets. You want to know how to think about the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem? You want to know how to think about the end? Point number one, don't be alarmed by doomsday prophets. Don't be alarmed by doomsday deceivers. We see that so clearly in verse 4. See that no one leads you astray. Why? Verse 5, because many will come in my name, false messiahs, saying, I am the Christ, and they will lead many astray. Even if a teaching is popular, that doesn't make it true. For many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, there will be many astray, and you will hear of wars, in rumors of wars. Here's Jesus' direction again. See that you are not alarmed. See that you're not alarmed when there are wars or rumors of wars. Why? Because these things must take place, but, quote, the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation. Kingdom will rise against kingdom. There will be famines. And there will be earthquakes in various places. But all these things, Jesus says, are but the beginnings of the birth pains. Jesus suggests that there will be a lot of difficult things in the history of the world after his death and resurrection. Wars. Nothing funny about war. Famines. Nothing funny about famines. Serious earthquakes that might kill thousands of people at once. These things will happen. But Jesus says these things are like Braxton Hicks contractions. If you've been pregnant, you understand what a Braxton Hicks contraction is. I haven't been pregnant, so I don't. But I understand they hurt. I understand they're real. I understand they're a sign that a baby is eventually coming. But they're not yet the end. They're contractions that aren't a part of labor and delivery coming in just a couple of hours. They're precursors. They hurt. They're real. They're part of a process leading toward a real end, but they're not yet the end. And in a similar way, Jesus says, when you hear that there are wars, when you hear that there are famines, when you hear that there are earthquakes. So whether it's human atrocities or weather atrocities, when you hear about these things, don't jump to the conclusion. Don't be alarmed. Don't be duped by doomsday deceivers into thinking it's the end. Realize these are a part of a process that's leading somewhere, but like Braxton Hicks contractions, it's not the end yet. Jesus says, when you see things like this, there's real pain. It's not going to be easy, but it's not the end. And yet, today, my social media feed has a whole bunch of people in it who wear faith over fear t-shirts sometimes, and yet panic at every piece of news about a war near Jerusalem. People who wear faith over fear t-shirts and yet panic and raise alarm and try to get other people to panic when there's a solar eclipse nowhere near Jerusalem. Jesus says, don't be duped by doomsday deceivers. Jesus isn't minimizing the pain that may come from wars. And we as Christians should not minimize the pain that comes from wars. Jesus is not minimizing the pain that will come from famines or earthquakes. And we as Christians should not minimize the pain associated with famines and earthquakes. We take these things seriously. But when we see them as Christians, we see their pain, and yet we say this is not the end of the world. Not dismissively, but with a kind of steadiness rooted in the teaching of Jesus that frees us from getting tugged about by every doomsday deceiver who wants to mess with our emotions. Do you feel that kind of freedom in your life? That freedom to not get tugged around by every doomsday deceiver in your social media feed? Jesus wants you to have that kind of freedom. This is the clear do not in Jesus' teaching. Do not be deceived by doomsday prophets. Many times they're just decoys. But now we need to dig in a little more deeply to the details of Jesus' teaching. The disciples asked a question. When is the destruction of the temple going to happen? And what's the sign of the end? They've got a twofold question. In their mind, it's one big question. But they've got a sincere question. And Jesus begins by saying, don't be deceived by the doomsday prophets. But Jesus is going to have more to say than simply don't get duped. He's actually going to give some answers to their questions. But the answers that Jesus gives, unfortunately, sometimes can be a little bit confusing for us. This is not the easiest stuff to understand, in part because it seems to me that some of the things that Jesus talks about in this passage are not the end, and some of the things that Jesus talks about in this passage will be at the end. And it makes it a little bit difficult to understand how those things work together. At some level, I think everybody, could understand and agree with what I just said. Some of the things are not the end, and some of them are. I think most Christians would agree with me on that. However, if we recognize that some are not the end and some are the end, we still have to do some hard work to sort out our understanding of which are not and which are. And we have to do some hard work to think about how far apart are these events that are not the end and are the ends. And Christians will come up with different answers to these questions as they try to sort these things out. I've got my understanding, but as I said, I'm not as certain about my understanding of this passage as I am in my understanding of other passages. Maybe I can summarize for you a couple of different views on this. One view about the details that Jesus teaches here emphasizes that most of what Jesus talks about in this passage is not the end. And in fact, from where we stand today in 2024, most of them happened a long time ago. Specifically, many people, let's say people like R.C. Sproul, if you know who that Christian teacher is, or Sam Storms. The names aren't that important. I'm just kind of saying there are some people who would emphasize pretty much everything in Matthew 24 happened a long time ago. Pretty much everything Jesus was pointing to, it happened a long time ago around the year 70 AD. So about 30 years after Jesus died and rose again, 35 years after Jesus died and rose again. They would say most of that happened around the year 70 AD when the temple that Jesus was looking at literally was demolished and destroyed by the Roman Empire. When the temple that Jesus and his disciples are looking at, and Jesus says, not one stone is going to lie on top of the other, and the disciples say, when is it going to happen? And Jesus says, let me tell you about it, and then it happened in this generation. To use a phrase that Jesus uses often in this passage. So some folks like R.C. Sproul or Sam Storms would say almost everything described there happened around the year 70 A.D. I'll tell you what I like about that explanation is that it takes seriously the setting that Jesus was in when he made these statements. And it takes seriously the fact that Jesus uses the phrase this generation repeatedly. And nowhere else in the Gospels does Jesus talk about this generation except to refer literally to this generation that was standing around him as he said these things. So I appreciate that about the view that R.C. Sproul and others like him hold. My hesitation with it is that by the time Jesus is done talking over on the Mount of Olives, he's going to be talking about the separation of sheep and goats in this climactic judgment scene that seems to have absolutely nothing to do with the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. It seems to be way out there in the future, at the end. And so on the one hand, you've got some people who say pretty much everything that Jesus talks about in Matthew 24 happened already from our point of view in AD 70, even though that was still future for the people who were standing around Jesus as he said it. There's another group, by and large, that would tend to say, no, everything, pretty much everything that Jesus talks about in Matthew 24 has to do with events that from our perspective here in the year 2024 haven't yet happened. Pretty much everything here is stuff that's supposed to happen with the end. What I like about that view is it takes seriously the end kinds of things that we'll see in the coming weeks in Jesus' teaching on the Mount of Olives. It takes really seriously that Jesus wants to get to the end, by the time he's done teaching about this stuff. And so it wants to process all of these things in that framework. I like that about it. But the downside, maybe, is the flip side of what I was saying about the other. Jesus talks about things happening in this generation. And Jesus uses language that seems best suited to answer the question, when is this temple going to get destroyed? And that's, after all, what starts the conversation. That temple doesn't exist anymore. It's not a future-oriented thing. It happened. It's gone. It's destroyed. It's demolished. So how do we hold these things together? By the way, there are more than two or three views on these things. Some of you who have studied it a lot might know there are dozens and dozens of views, even among American Christians, on how these things hold together. I want to argue, or I want to say my view of these things is a little bit to say there's something good about that and there's something good about that, I want to suggest it makes the most sense to me to read this passage and say that from our perspective, some of it has already happened and some of it has not yet happened. Some of it's already happened. Some of it has not yet happened. And so it makes the most sense to me to read it that way. And let me show you how I think that makes sense of things. I'm going to show you in three movements of this text how I read it. Which is not to say this is the only way that any Christians anywhere read it. It's how I read it. And I hope perhaps it provides some illumination for you as well. In verses 9 through 14, what is Jesus doing? In verses 9 through 14, I think Jesus is showing a progression from apocalyptic suffering that is not the end, leading to the true end after the gospel has been proclaimed in the whole world. So if you just put your eyes on those verses for just a second and skim over them with me, it starts with, they will deliver you, speaking to his disciples right in front of him, they will deliver you disciples up to tribulation and put you to death, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will fall away, many false prophets will arise, and because lawlessness will be increased, the love of many will grow cold, but the one who endures to the end will be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom, it's the gospel that Jesus has been preaching throughout the book of Matthew. This gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. There are things here as Jesus is speaking to his disciples about how you will be persecuted, about how you will be put to death, that to me make the most sense to say he's starting at the runway level where they are right there. And there really was a time of persecution coming up within the lifetime of his disciples in which many of them really would be persecuted, in which many of them would be put to death. But by the time he's done giving this encapsulated overview, he's not only answering their question about when the temple will be destroyed, it'll be destroyed in about 70 AD, he's also talking about the ends, which is probably something bigger than just the destruction of the temple or the end of the temple, right? So as I read verses 9 through 14, I think Jesus is showing a progression from apocalyptic kind of suffering that is not the end, leading all the way to the true end after the gospel has been preached in all of the world. Well, where does Jesus go from there? Verse 15, he's going to zigzag back, kind of the way that Genesis 1 and 2 zigzags a little bit. Kind of the way that sometimes when we tell stories, we say, let me tell you the whole story, now let me tell you a little bit more about this part of it. I think Jesus zigzags back in verse 15. So when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel, so what is Jesus doing next? He's zigzagging back and saying, okay, but now I want to talk a little bit more about the apocalyptic suffering that is not the end yet, that Daniel prophesied, that Daniel explained. And Jesus will take some time in verses 15 to 28 explaining something important about Daniel's prophecy and what Daniel envisions related to what we sometimes translate as an abomination. Now, this refers to something that Daniel talks about four times in the biblical book of Daniel. Probably most clearly it shows up in Daniel chapter 9 verse 26 when the prophet Daniel foresaw a time when the people of the prince who is to come, he's not a good guy, shall destroy the city, that's Jerusalem, and the sanctuary, that's the heart of the temple. Its end shall come with a flood, and to the end there shall be war. Desolations are decreed, and he shall make a strong covenant with many for 1 week. And for half of the week he shall put an end to sacrifice and offering. Well, This is how apocalyptic prophets in the Old Testament speak. I'm not going to unpack that in all its detail today. But I think as Jesus comes back to these kinds of descriptions from the book of Daniel about a time coming when one will destroy the city and the sanctuary, when one will put an end to sacrifices and offerings that would have been made previously in the temple, Jesus picks up this theme and he begins preparing people for when that happens. And so beginning in verse 16, Jesus says, "Let those who are left in Judea flee to the mountains. Let the one who is on the housetop not go down." And there are all these descriptions about how to flee to the mountains when you're in Judea, when this destruction happens in Jerusalem. How to get out of the house quick enough. What to pray for. Pray that this won't be on a Sabbath day. And so forth. What is Jesus doing here? My understanding is that Jesus is preparing his disciples for a day that really would come in their generation, when a serious destruction of the city of Jerusalem and the temple was going to come. And he gives a whole bunch of directions for them for how to flee from the city rather than staying and fighting for the stones that are meant to be toppled over. He gives them all kinds of descriptions for how they can flee from that specific great tribulation that was to come in the days of Jesus, but is now, in my understanding, many years behind us in the year 2024. Why? Because just as Jesus said, this stuff happened. Just as Daniel foresaw, the city was absolutely ravished within a generation of Jesus' life. The temple was destroyed. Maybe it's not quite true that there was not a single stone attached to another, but there are actually reports about how Roman soldiers found gold lining the bricks, and so they dismantled it brick by brick to melt the gold off of the bricks to increase their loot that they could carry away from that destruction that they carried out in the year 70 AD. And so the brick by brick destruction of the temple, the citywide desolation or destruction that was within a generation of Jesus' life. Jesus is preparing his disciples, saying, you want to know about when it's going to happen, that glorious building is going to be toppled over? Here's what you need to know. First of all, don't get duped about the end. Secondly, be prepared. Be prepared for it. And what does this mean for us? We do need to take it seriously. But we don't need an exit plan for how we're going to get into Judean mountains someday. Do you see what I'm saying? Here in Aurora, Illinois, if God's final days plan is to get into the mountains, we're in trouble. And especially if they're Judean mountains that are 5,000 or 7,000, how many miles away are those, Matt? 7,000 miles, 5,000? They're a long way from here. We're in trouble if God's plan is to get to those Judean mountains. But why is Jesus so specific about getting into Judean mountains? Because he's preparing Judean Christians for a real tribulation that is to come. So how do we apply this? We apply this kind of like how we apply Exodus chapter 12, verse 11. With directions about how the Hebrew people would bake bread quickly and eat it while wearing a belt in haste with a staff in hand. Look, you're not disobeying Exodus chapter 12, verse 11 in the year 2024 if you don't eat bread quickly wearing a belt with a staff in your hand and trying to cross the Red Sea, right? Why? Because that was an instruction for something that happened. And we don't need to go and try to rehearse it and repeat it again. In a similar way, my understanding of how we read Matthew chapter 24, verses 15 through 28, is that Jesus was preparing people for a real event that was going to come within their generation, that they really needed to know how to get into the mountains for safety. They needed to get out of the city. They needed to be prepared to go with all haste once the armies of the prince who is to come, as Daniel says, arrived. They had to do it. But it's already happened. And so we don't need to design exit strategies for getting into mountains today, right? So if there's a first part of Jesus' teaching, don't be deceived. As Jesus gets into details here, he gives us an overview of what's to come. And some of the overview then goes back to Daniel and says, look, there's a day coming when the city and the place where sacrifices are made is going to be destroyed. Get to safety. From our perspective, that happened a long time ago. Does this have anything to say to us? Yes, it does. Because as I understand it, Jesus also has some things to say here that have not yet happened in 2024. As I read this passage, when we get out to verses 29 through 31, Jesus now begins to answer some of the disciples' question about the sign. Remember, the disciples had a two-part question. When's that going to happen that the temple gets destroyed? And what's the sign of the end of the age? Jesus told them about the destruction of the temple, but he still wants to tell them about the sign of the end of the age. And he does so beginning in verse 29 as I read it. After the tribulation, immediately of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light and the stars will fall from heaven and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then will appear in heaven the sign. They asked about a sign. This is the first time Jesus says, then will appear the sign. The other things were Braxton Hicks, but this is the real thing. Then will appear the sign. What is it? The Son of Man. And then all the tribes of the earth will mourn. And they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. Here Jesus is referring to something else that the prophet Daniel foresaw in Daniel chapter 7. Verses 13 and 14, I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven there came one like a Son of Man, and he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him, and to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. Not just the people in one region, the people of the whole earth will serve him. This is the sign that Jesus is drawing attention to. And in Jesus' view, this sign will be as unmistakable as lightning in the sky. You're not sitting around wondering, well, that guy's a really persuasive speaker. I wonder if he's the Messiah. Well, that guy's a really persuasive speaker. Maybe I should be alarmed about these wars and rumors of wars. There won't be wondering about it. Like lightning in the sky, it will be unmistakable, Jesus says. Unmistakable. This is the sign that Jesus draws attention to. It's the sign of his return. In glory. So unmistakably that not just a few people in one region, but so unmistakably that people from every nation, people who speak every language on the planet, will be drawn together to serve and worship him. One man commanding the allegiance of all the nations. This is the unmistakable sign that Jesus offers of the end of the age. His glorious return, when every knee will bow and tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of the Father. This is the very good end of the story. the very good end of the story that does not depend on you or me to make it happen. The very good end of the story that depends on Him and what the Lamb who was slain has already accomplished. The very good end of the story that will result in thousands upon thousands and multitudes upon multitudes bowing down and crying out in worship, "Worthy is the One who sits on the throne and the Lamb." And listen, even if you disagree with my understanding of one or two details in this text, this is the very good ending that we are all longing for, isn't it? When He will return in His glory and command the allegiance of all the nations at once. One man being worshipped by people from every language, from every tribe, from every nation. One man. "Worthy is the One who sits on the throne and the Lamb." This is the very good end of the story that does not depend on us, but depends on His glory and His ability to save those who have been given to Him. We need to say something before we wrap up about the discipleship in Jesus' teaching. We need to say something about it at least. I've pointed out that Jesus has some do nots. Don't get deceived by doomsday prophets. He's got some descriptions of details throughout this passage, some of which we'll understand in slightly different ways, and that's okay, I think, as long as we're trying to pay attention to what Jesus Himself says. But where does this leave us as disciples? If we put together the do nots of Jesus and the details that Jesus gives, what does this mean for disciples? Here's what I think is the main point of this passage. How should we prepare for apocalyptic events? And how should we prepare for the end of the world? Here's my summary of the point for disciples. Don't be alarmed about the ends, but do be faithful to the ends. Don't need to be alarmed by all of that, but you do need to be faithful. Don't be alarmed about the end, but instead use this depiction of the end to motivate you to be faithful all the way through every kind of tribulation you may face. Through every kind of war, through every kind of famine, through every kind of earthquake, through every kind of persecution, through every kind of death of a loved one, be faithful to the end. Don't be alarmed. Instead, be faithful. What does faithfulness mean? Two clues in this passage that I want to draw your attention to in verses 13 and 14. Matthew chapter 24, verse 13 says something that, you know what, a bunch of people in our church just studied the book of Revelation. Doesn't this sound a lot like the book of Revelation? Matthew 24, 13, "But the one who endures to the end will be saved." First of all, there's a faithfulness in personal discipleship that is called for. A faithfulness in personal endurance that is called for in this text. So that no matter what trials we face, no matter what would seek to pull us away from Jesus and His mission, we remain loyal and dedicated to Him. But in addition to faithfulness, including our personal endurance, our faithfulness, according to this passage, should also include a faithfulness to what we might call global evangelism. Not only personal endurance, but global evangelism. Why? Because here's what the whole thing is still waiting for. Here's the goal. Verse 14, "This gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come." There's an urgency in Matthew 24, not only about personally enduring through any kind of trial we face, but about globally spreading this message of hope, globally spreading the good news of Him and the opportunity to be invited into His kingdom. The good news that every man, woman, and child from every tribe, language, and nation is invited to join in worshiping and serving Him, the one who has triumphed for us on our behalf. This good news is good news that can fuel us in our own personal endurance, and it should fuel us in engaging others in loving mission throughout the journey, right? How should we prepare for apocalyptic events and the end of the world? Don't be alarmed about the end. Instead, be faithful to the end. You hear how this answer is a little bit different than some of the answers that swirl around us, right? Ariana Grande, if the end is coming, make sure you're with someone you love. That's sweet. R.E.M.'s answer, if the end is coming, make sure you feel fine. I don't know, I hope you have fine emotions. I don't always, but I hope you do. Prince's answer, if the end is coming, make sure you first party like it's 1999. Really? Is that the meaning of it all? Is that what human flourishing is all about? Is that what your life was made for? Here's Jesus' answer. If the end is coming, be faithful to Him. If the end is coming, remain loyal to the Lamb who was slain. If the end is coming, then keep on enduring and keep on spreading this message of hope until that day when every knee bows and every tongue confesses that Jesus Christ truly is Lord. And in the meantime, no matter how many trials and tribulations we may weave through, we can do so prepared by Jesus with this awareness. If the end is coming, and it is, then let's be faithful to Him who loved us and gave Himself for us.